Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Well, hello there, Santa Cruz. It's me, Dr. Dawn Motika, here with an hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. And wow, this is exciting. It's a squid of a different color. It's K-Squid 90.7 FM, and you are listening to Dr. Dawn. So I wanted to start out pinging off of something I heard in the previous Talk of the Bay, which was talking about those bright neon bicycles that are out there. And I kind of want to remind you about all of those football players with the concussions, and that we have a helmet law in California that says that if you are under the age of 18, you have to have a helmet. Well, it's not like the concussion fairy appears at the stroke of your birthday when you turn 18, and somehow you have like this magic invisible helmet that's going to protect you. And it worries me to see all these people tooling around the street on little motorized scooter bicycles with no helmets on. Now, I went and got my jump thing when I saw that they were going. I haven't, and I just will not, and I recommend you do not use it without a helmet. In the event that you fall and hit your head, you can suffer brain damage, and this is no trivial matter. In fact, the older you are, the more likely you are to trigger dementia with a mild concussion. This is nothing you want to play with. So get yourself a lightweight bicycle helmet, make sure it fits, and, you know, stuff it in your backpack and pop it on your noggin when you jump on those bikes. It's super important. And I hope to see modifications to our law in 2019 or later on, because everyone should be wearing a helmet when they ride a bicycle. So a recent survey came out that I thought I would talk to you about. This was done by the American Medical Association, and it was looking at these things called prior authorizations. I don't know if you've heard of these. If you've been to the doctor, you might have heard, oh, wait, we have to get a prior authorization for that. Well, let me give you some stats about prior auths. This was a survey of 1,000 practicing physicians, and it was a real big deal to these doctors. 91% said that prior authorizations from insurance companies negatively impact patient clinical outcomes. 65% of them report waiting at least one business day for authorizations, and a quarter of them said they wait 3 days or longer. Here's where the rubber meets the road on this. This is supposed to save the insurance companies money by limiting care. So the licensed MD who has determined that this care or procedure should be done has to call up and talk to someone who may have a degree after high school but doesn't have to, who is working off basically a cheat sheet that says deny and make them do it again. This runs into some serious money, and a lot of it is uncompensated labor. I can tell you from my own experience, just last week, I had a patient who had a neck CT scan for a injury that was like a industrial injury. And she came into my office and showed it to me, and it said, it looks like the C4 vertebrae in the neck is replaced by cancer. You should probably do some additional studies, doctors, and see where it's coming from. Okay, so I get on the phone and try to reach the insurance company and request a prior authorization for the appropriate medical workup in this setting, which is where you have an unknown cancer. You want a CT of the lungs and the abdomen and the pelvis, because those are the places where cancers are possibly lurking. You also want to get, in the case of a female, a mammogram, because breast cancers love to go to bone. This is a healthy person with no history, so I have no clue. We're on a fishing expedition. And it's 3:30 in the afternoon, which meant that the prior authorization people were closing in about a half an hour. So because they're all on the East Coast, right? Just like the stock market. So I got on the phone and waited about the typical 25 minutes, talked to one person, then they let me talk to another person. Then I punched some more numbers into a machine, and finally I get someone, and they let me know that they will submit this and I might hear by tomorrow. And again, I don't hear by tomorrow, so I have to call in again. It was extremely stressful. It consumed about 90 minutes in total of my time. And meanwhile, you know, I'm sweating out whether my patient has something really serious going on and what else is hiding in there. So the average medical practice completes 31 prior authorizations a week per doctor, each of them taking about half an hour. That works out to 14.9 unpaid hours. That's nearly 2 business days for a full-time equivalent. And let me emphasize this again. None of this is compensated. We don't get paid to do prior authorizations. It's part of our obligation. And as primary care doctors, it's insane. If you wonder why all the single primary care practices are drying up, well, this is a big piece. Most practices, 36% of physicians have to employ a full-time employee or a part-time employee just to do prior auths, just to sit there on the phone and go through this stuff. We've been trying to get the feds and the state to look at this, and California Medical Association is going to be trying to get prior auths outlawed. I would love to know if you've had a problem with prior auths, if your life-saving drug has been delayed, if you've had cancer chemotherapy delayed, or a surgery delayed because we were waiting for the bureaucracy to show us exactly that. So let's go to the next story. And that one is some real news you can lose. Sorry, news you can use. What an interesting Freudian slip. Well, it is about losing, so maybe that's where it came from. This was looking at people in the age range of 55 to 80 who were either overweight or obese. And some of them had high blood pressure, some of them didn't. What the researchers did very scientifically and in a lab condition with controlled diet the night before and during the study, measuring blood pressure and adrenaline levels during each 8-hour stretch, basically what they had people do was lots of different variations of sitting, standing, and walking. What they found worked the best was before you sit down at work, if you do 30 minutes of morning exercise on a treadmill, and it doesn't have to be fast, it can just be normal walking speed, that you will get an 8-hour benefit on lowering your blood pressure and your adrenaline. Furthermore, and this was only true of women in this age group, 55 to 80, so postmenopausal women, they found that women who took a 3-minute break from sitting every half hour, even if it was just to walk to the bathroom or walk to the water cooler, 3 minutes of standing, possibly while they're on the phone, I can think of lots of ways I could implement this myself, they would themselves have an increased benefit that would last even longer. And they saw drops of up to 20% on systolic blood pressure and 10% on diastolic blood pressure. These are substantial decreases. By the way, if you come up with a blood pressure pharmaceutical that could drop the systolic by 20 and the diastolic by 10, it would be a blockbuster drug. It would be hugely, hugely desirable for people because most of the drugs don't drop blood pressure nearly as well as that. The numbers call again here at KSQD, KSQD 90.7 FM is 831-900-5773. And what do you want to bet? That spells KSQD. So come and join us for the new Squid on the Block Ask Dr. Dawn every Wednesday at 6 p.m. So our next story is about how a fungus can cripple the immune system. And this is important because we are in fungi central. There is a guy who lectures a lot about fungus and has just really solid science on the subject of mycotoxins, which are these little volatile chemicals that fungus excrete. You've probably heard of volatile organic compounds, things that off-gas from new furniture, for example, or vinyl flooring or carpeting or paint. Well, fungi put out VOCs as well, and right now everyone's probably got some fungi growing around the edges of their home. One of the most common fungi that we see is Aspergillus fumigatus. And Aspergillus is a little black mold. It's not the horrible black mold. You could just see it even in microscopically small amounts in bathrooms. But if you swab and do fungal cultures, you'll find it in most houses in Santa Cruz. Now, I'm not trying to freak you out here, because people who are healthy have no problem fighting off the toxin, gliotoxin, that Aspergillus puts off. But researchers are concerned about people who are on immunosuppressive drugs or people with untreated AIDS because their immune system is already compromised and they're really a setup for the fungus being able to actually infect humans. We're going to geek out a little bit because, hey, that's part of my trademark. I love to geek out. And while we geek out, I'll tell you that a little bit about how Aspergillus gliotoxin works. Before I do that, though, I want you to know that you can get a urine test for gliotoxin, and this is a extremely simple thing to do. You send in some urine, and if you have that toxin in your system, it's tested. I don't think your insurance is going to pay for this, but it won't cost you more than about $100. So if you're really worried or you are on immunosuppressive drugs, it's probably worth doing to see whether you need to decontaminate your environment. So how does it work? Well, it turns out that gliotoxin inhibits the production of a very important enzyme in neutrophils. These are the granulocytes, the polynuclear granulocytes. When we do a CBC with a white count, these are the first responders to infection. Their job is to recognize that there's an infection, and then they have these little, think of them as baggies of chemical signals that they release. They're sort of the smoke alarm, as I said. So they release a compound called leukotriene that attracts other immune cells. And this spreads through the bloodstream, and the cells in the bloodstream and the rest of the body can home in on it and find the source of the infection. Well, ordinarily, whenever an infectious agent is found, this is what triggers the whole alarm system. Gliotoxin actually inhibits the production of this chemical messenger, leukotriene B4, prevents it from being produced. This allows the Aspergillus to just sit where it is in a stealth mode and grow and invade tissues or organs. We are going to go to our first caller now. I believe that we have someone on the air. Hello, caller.
I believe this is your celebratory initial show, as I understand.
It is the kickoff, and you know, the kickoff is always interesting. So how are you today?
Well, welcome back to the airwaves. We've missed you. You're such a great entertainer and educator. So my name is Frank. I'm calling from Santa Cruz, and I've listened to you for many years and very much appreciate your style and intellect and patience with a variety of callers.
Oh, well, thank you.
So I have a question. I'm 61 years old, pretty good health, 20 pounds overweight, depending where I throw the dart on the BMI scale, and take blood pressure meds, you know, statin for cholesterol, all that stuff. In the last several years, I've started to develop some memory issues.
Okay.
And those issues have manifest itself as slowness in recalling a name, not so much facial recognition, movie directors, you know, bits and pieces. I'm in sales, so it's sort of the tools of the trade is to be able to come up with names and recall easily. So I started reading things and took myself off statins, and cholesterol went through the roof. So I'm back on statins right now, but came across an interesting book. I think it's called The End of Alzheimer's by Dr. Dale Bresden. And I'm about halfway through that. And they make, in this book, they sort of talk about the causes of Alzheimer's, and more importantly, that this doctor and I think several folks involved have been able to cure people, which is a huge, huge statement. Apparently, they have some data, and he has a protocol that he calls RECODE, which involves a bunch of different things. I'm halfway through the book, so I'm probably not terribly literate to speak to any detail, but maybe you could perhaps shed a little bit of light on such an outrageous claim. And the claim is more than just curing Alzheimer's, but also, you know, sort of subsets of that in terms of memory loss, and it's categorized into different pieces.
Exactly. Let me just say that I'm very familiar with Dr. Bredesen's work, and at my practice over on Bishop Street, we do actually have people on a Bredesen protocol. The way that I think of his work is it's kind of the death of a thousand paper cuts is how he thinks of neuronal death. When you look at what he's come up with in his RECODE program, he's basically gone through the literature, and he has 20 years of working in the field of dementia, and he's gone through the literature and looked at all of the things that have been identified as being problematic, and he's categorized dementia into several different categories. So it's great that you called, because we'll start with his third category, which is toxic dementia. And so a person can get toxic dementia from mycotoxins, which I was talking about just a moment ago, or lead or mercury or arsenic, and or a combination of those things. And the toxic dementias are also seen in toxicology. We're very well aware that people who have high levels of metal will develop a mental changes. So when a person gets poisoned by mercury, yeah, they'll have some changes in their fingernails, but they'll also have some changes in their thinking. And
Mad Hatter's disease is the old term.
There you go. So that's a great example of, because the people who did the hats back in Victorian England used mercury, mercuric vapor, I believe it was mercuric chloride. And part of that was fumigating the birds and the feathers that they put on the hats. And part of it was, I think, to make the wool so that it wouldn't get eaten by moths. But these things were, the hatters were exposed in very high levels. And so they would go mad. So exactly right. So when you see that kind of when you see a sudden onset of dementia, that's more likely to be toxic, but it can also be an insidious process just from brain cell death, because you were talking about statins, and statins reduce the level of CoQ10. And what happens when the levels of CoQ10 fall below a certain level in a mitochondria is that the mitochondria is no longer able to produce enough energy. And if enough of the mitochondria drop their CoQ10 levels, they will get together and say, you know, this neuron, we're just not able to keep it together. This property is condemned. And they'll pull a suicide switch called apoptosis, and the nerve cell dies. Well, obviously, decline and loss of nerve cells is a feature of all of the dementing diseases. So it's no surprise that this is happening at a more under-the-radar level rather than an acute poisoning. So part of the Bredesen protocol is looking for toxins. And you do ask about mold and exposures and all of the sorts of toxins and toxic exposures that a person might have occupationally. They're all potentially a factor. And statins would fit into that category. There is definitely something called statin brain. And I've had people's cognition improve substantially when they stop their statin. By the way, Frank, did you notice a shift in your name retrieval after you did this, after you stopped the statin? Could you?
I did notice an improvement. I wouldn't say it was noticeable, but not dramatic, perhaps is the right word.
Okay. Sometimes you can revisit the statin and take high doses of coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol. I usually, if someone's on a statin, I'll have them take about 300 milligrams a day of ubiquinol. That seems to, in some individuals, enough of it gets into the brain that they don't get the statin brain. They don't get the sort of brownout effect from the energy. And so
I see.
It's worth a shot. As far as the other parts of the Bredesen protocol, I'm just going to riff on the other two. And of course, you can have more than one form of toxicity. The next one he calls is the sweet Alzheimer's. And this is also sometimes called type 3 diabetes, although that term's gotten, there's a fight over who gets to use the term for type 3 diabetes. But we used to have 1 and 2. Now we have 1.5 and 3. And 3 is dementia associated with diabetes. And we have strong data that if you have poorly controlled diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes, that your dementia hits you about 10 years earlier, which is huge. It's about the amount of time that your heart attack hits you statistically. So, you know, John Doe, poorly controlled diabetic, he gets his heart attack at 45 rather than 55. 55 would have been no surprise. 45 is a little on the young side. And with the dementia, it's the same thing. It's about 10 years earlier. We think the culprit here is insulin levels. That thing, beta amyloid, that is, we see accumulated kind of like newspapers in the hallway of an old person who's got a little bit of hoarder syndrome. Well, people develop beta amyloid deposits, and they're called plaques in the brain. And we can diagnose Alzheimer's actually by doing some special kind of MRI that looks for, it may not be MRI, it may be a PET scan, that looks at amyloid plaque. But the point is we can see it in the brain. We can also measure byproducts of amyloid in the spinal column. And these things are being done now to identify true Alzheimer's so that we can try the drugs out on people, which, by the way, none of the drugs have worked. And I'll come back to that in a second, why that's true. But controlling the diabetes, getting the insulin levels down. So diet is huge in that type of glucotoxic Alzheimer's disease. And then the first kind is the inflammatory Alzheimer's. And this is where there's extra inflammation in the brain, and the inflammation itself is driving the production of beta amyloid. So in the brain, if there's inflammation and the cells that are the glial cells, which are the granulocyte analog, I was talking about granulocytes earlier in the blood and in the body. Well, in the brain, the glial cells play that role. And what they do is they excrete inflammatory substances, and we're trying not to get inflammation in the brain. And people with inflammation in the brain trigger the formation of more beta amyloid. And that's not clear to me why we get that inflammation, but we do.
I think he says it's a reaction. It's the brain trying to protect itself by creating beta amyloids to the inflamed environment. I think that's part of his theory.
Right. And so if you have more inflammation, you'll have more beta amyloid, therefore potentially you'll produce more plaque. And it's a dynamic balance between the buildup and the breakdown of plaque. And that's really where I think a lot of research should be going, is to try and stimulate the production of alpha amyloid, which is harmless and protective against. And so you get a sort of a feedback loop. The more beta amyloid you have, the more amyloid will be cleaved in the direction of beta. The less beta amyloid you have, the more the system will make alpha, and then alpha will make more alpha. And so it becomes kind of a vicious cycle. Now, any kind of infection that is neurotropic can be a factor here. So, for example, we've known for 20 years that if you have oral herpes, that there's a higher rate of Alzheimer's disease as you age, and particularly if you have other risk factors like a family history. And the people who have the double ApoE4, which, as far as we know, has nothing whatsoever to do with amyloid, but somehow having more ApoE4 makes your immune system more aggressive. So people with high levels of ApoE4 have less infections, or they fight them off better. But when they have a chronic infection, they just keep fighting. And they have more inflammation. So you'll find...
And you can actually test for that gene, is that right?
You can test for that gene, 23andMe. And you can get that test also through all the standard labs. We'll do it as well.
Mm. Interesting. So it sounds like it's part of the recode is then to go to characterize toxins, levels of inflammation, and then based on those test results, significant changes in lifestyles, from what I've read.
Well, a lot of it's lifestyle. Yeah. Exercise is, of course, one of the few things we know about that increase brain-derived growth factor. And so that will cause you to make more new nerve cells, which turns out we can do that. So it's incredibly important to be active. And there are other factors as well. But if someone has a history of outbreaks of herpes, I'm putting them on suppressive Valtrex as part of the Bredesen protocol because I just...
Oh, the antiviral.
Yeah, yep. The antiviral. Let's keep that virus from... Let's keep those outbreaks from happening because every time they happen, you're going to get some you're going to get some stuff in the cells.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
All right.
Well, this has been very helpful.
Yeah, I know it was a big download, but we'll have this up on the station. I don't know if it's going to be up this week, but we will definitely have it up at the Ask Dr. Don website within a couple of weeks, so you can listen to it again.
Indeed, no, that would be helpful. And the book is widely available. I think I have it on Audible right now. I'm listening to it on commute. So sort of this scientific dissertation into actionable stuff is really the place I'm going through right now. So great to have you back in the air. Hopefully the fan base is just going to go through the roof.
Well, thank you very much for your question, Frank, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Dr. Don. Take care.
Bye-bye. And you are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz. We are at 90.7 FM, so come and join us. You can call, if you have a question, 900-5773. That's 900-5773. We had talked about morning exercise and how important that is. Let's talk about something else. I'm sitting back from the mic, sorry. Okay, let's go to one of Dr. Don's favorite topics, which is the microbiome. And we've already talked a little bit about infections. This relates to human papillomavirus, which causes 99% of cervical cancer. And it's quite significant. This is how we look for cervical cancer now. We test for the virus. We used to do pap smears as our screen test, but that has been more or less replaced with HPV. If a person is HPV positive, we have to watch them very carefully. Turns out that the bacteria in the vagina actually make a difference in whether or not HPV lesions are going to progress to cancerous or simply go away. And there are several bacteria that have been identified as being risk factors for progression to cancer, and they include Mycoplasma, Pseudomonas, and Staphylococcus. Now, I want to point out that these three types of bacteria have no business being in the vagina, and they should be kept out of the vagina by adequate levels of lactobacillus and a good low vaginal pH. So we are having a chicken and the egg moment on this. Is the bacteria getting in there, and then that's allowing the HPV to be more aggressive and mutate the cells that leads to cervical cancer? Is that what's going on? Is it, in other words, creating a permissive environment for cancer? That's my bet. But another possibility, let's be scientific, because correlation is not causation, and people make that mistake a lot, could be that the presence of HPV somehow impairs the immune system or shifts the pH in a way that allows these bacteria, which normally prefer a higher pH, to get in there. As anyone who used to listen to my show knows, I'm very big on the gut microbiome, and the bacteria in the vagina can easily be colonized with bacteria from the colon, not too surprising, and this is a really interesting association that's just been turned up. This came from the American Society for Microbiology, and it's new. It's a new study. Where are we going with this? Well, at the moment, nowhere. But in the future, it may be possible. If I can really see it, if a person comes up positive for HPV, what I used to do was put them, and still do as far as that goes, is put them on a high dose of folic acid, about 2 milligrams a day, which is a high dose, because that has been shown to reduce the progression and promote the reversal of early precancerous cervical changes. In a couple of years, I may be doing some microbiome gardening on those women as well and having them take certain antibacterial substances or maybe even inoculate the vagina with protective bacteria to beat back the Pseudomonas and the Mycoplasma and the other species that are somehow involved in setting up that permissive environment. And we're really, really not at this point sure. We're going to our next caller. Hello to Roseanne in New Jersey.
Yes, Dr. Dawn, and I am thrilled that you are back on the air and every single week.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
And thank you for sticking it out. It's been a long dry spell.
And I also heard you tell the other caller that these will be on podcast.
Yes, that's right.
Perfect, perfect, because I have you on my iPod with all yours. We talk, on occasion, I hear you talk about strontium.
Yes.
For bones. I have never heard you recommend, though, that you should be under doctor's care for that and have blood work done, because you do know Dr. Josh Axe. I was reading something from him. He recommends it, but he recommends having blood work done.
Hmm.
And I've never heard anybody else recommend that.
No,
and
I haven't.
It's an over-the-counter.
I haven't either. What blood work is he recommending?
Good grief. I know something about the liver.
Hmm. Well, I think this is going to turn out to be one of those dose issues, but I don't have any awareness of, if he says it's liver, then we're checking liver enzymes. At the doses that I'm using, I am unaware of complications related to the liver. I usually use about 3 milligrams. There were studies done in Europe where higher doses were used of a different strontium called ranulate, strontium ranulate, which is not available in the United States. So possibly people have been using those doses, and but I really don't know the backstory. It is always a details thing, right? The devil's in the details. But I have never seen warnings so far. And if I'll look it up, I promise, and put that out next week. If there is in fact something I should be adding to my advice, to use boron and strontium as well as equal amounts of calcium and magnesium. And vitamin K2, the MK7 form, at least 100 micrograms of that, because we want that calcium going into the bones and not into the arteries.
Correct, yes. Been hearing lots about that. Yeah. If I can come across what he wrote about it, I can always email that to you.
Great, I would love it. You can email me at, go to the website and use the Contact Us button. You may have done that before. But
I'd
say it because people who are listening to me for the first time may be a little shy and they don't want to call in or they're listening on the podcast. But we always, always look for those emails. And I was really sad that I didn't have any new emails to kick off this inaugural show. But hey, it'll build.
I emailed you to find out when you'd be coming back on. And they did email me and told me you would be coming back on in February. So your team does do a good job of communicating with us when we do send emails out. So kudos to them for that.
Kudos to Charlie. Yes.
Okay. Regarding the strontium, I know you can't recommend brands. There are so many on the market, but is there anything we should be looking for
and
choosing?
Absolutely. Sourcing. Okay. So there's this outfit called Alibaba, which is the Amazon of China. And it's very similar to the way Amazon puts you together with people where Amazon's not selling it, but somebody's selling it through Amazon. And, and it's like that. But the problem is most of these suppliers are in China, and China has horrible pollution problems. They burn high sulfur coal, which means they have a lot of mercury. They have a lot of lead toxicity. They're not really very careful about their food and water supply. And, of course, the dirt is a problem. So when you mine something and it comes in a big bag from China, it should be checked. Every bag should be checked for lead and mercury and the usual suspects. And you can find out what the policies are for lead and mercury and other heavy metal testing, as well as some of the you know, DDT and some of the other things that are legal there and not legal here. Not to say that we're such angels when it comes to the when it comes to the pollutants. I mean, unfortunately, DDT never dies, and so even it's looping through the environment, and you can still find trace amounts in infants, even though it's been illegal for over 30 years in this country, because it's, you know, it's in the dirt. So,
wow.
I know, isn't that scary?
Yes.
Yeah. So the thing about this is there should be an independent laboratory that is testing for contaminants, and that's the terminology. So you can ask for a certificate of testing from the company, and you should get, they should have a certificate that they can send to you. You call the 800 number or you can email them. The reputable companies have this and will be happy to send it back to you because it costs them money to get that testing, and they would like to have a market advantage in return for being good citizens.
Oh, okay.
So, right.
I will. So how do you spell Alibaba? How did you spell
that? Alibaba. And it's interesting. I don't recommend buying stuff there, but I know that for many of the compounds that are used in nutraceuticals, China is literally the only source. So it's very, there are certain things that I don't buy from China. I don't buy Chinese herbs from China. There is a couple of companies that source some of their herbs because they just can't find them anywhere else, but they test the heck out of them. And so I'm comfortable using those companies. But it's true of almost all of the supplements now is that some of the stuff that's in there may only be available through Alibaba or through large Chinese vendors. You know, when you undercut the competition as drastically, well, say it's subsidized industry, right? So they can undercut the competition and basically drive the competition out of business, and they pretty much have.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's really been paying attention, and they've got a lock on a lot of things, particularly in the supplement market.
Well, hopefully with you speaking about this more and more people will pay attention.
Well, that's my hope. More and more.
Okay.
And more and more and more and more.
Good enough. All right. Thank you so much for your help, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
I learned so much from you.
Thank you so much, Roseanne.
Okay.
All right.
Bye. Okay. Good night.
Good night. So more on the microbiome, because like I said, it's my favorite topic. Effect of breastfeeding versus pumping on human milk microbiome. Now, this one, guys, is a trip. So you probably heard when you were growing up that breast milk was sterile. Well, it turns out it's not. Breast milk actually has small amounts of bacteria, these particularly bifidobacteria, infantis. And this one comes from the intestine of the mom. It gets into the lymphatic system, climbs up to the lactating breast, and jumps into the breast milk and thence into the baby. And it's one of the main places that babies get their initial bacteria. So it's super important, most particularly if you are born by C-section, because you're not coming out through the vagina and you got some antibiotics during the C-section, which I wish is a practice that I wish would be stopped, but there you go. It'll take a while before that gets thought through. So a baby who's C-section has to be breastfed. It really is important. But, you know, moms go back to work, and they go back to work fairly early. Some of them, in fact, are having to use milk that's coming from other moms. And those moms are probably not wet nurses. They're probably pumping and donating their breast milk. So the researchers looked at the DNA of the bacteria in breast milk, and they looked at whether or not direct breastfeeding and indirect breastfeeding had an effect on the milk. Guess what? Duh. Yeah, it surely does. And if you are breastfeeding exclusively, then your milk has more oral bacteria. And if you are indirectly breastfeeding, one serving of pumped milk in the preceding 2 weeks, you have a higher level of opportunistic pathogens coming out of the breast milk. So babies who are getting pumped milk statistically have higher rates of asthma as infants than those who are fed exclusively breastfed. This is probably why. There's difference in the milk microbiota, and this affects the colonization of the infant gut microbiome. So in other words, by using a breast pump, you're actually changing the content of your milk because the bacteria somehow get into those ducts and shift. I don't know if it's, I know people are very good about being clean about their breast pumps, but this might be a reason to get even cleaner. And the numbers again are 900-5773. And we are going to Jody in Soquel. Hello, Jody.
Hi. I want to thank you for being such an amazing light and healer in our community, first of all. And what a wonderful resource you provide. So I have a bit of a puzzle to help have you help me navigate. I'm going to be 60 this summer, and I'm in good health usually. I exercise regularly. I love to paddleboard. I have a good diet, organic. I do have, unfortunately, a history of antibiotic use due to kidney infections and various accidents that I've had. Mm-hmm. But now, for about 2 years, I have a chronic, I guess, rather complicated ear infection and situation. My regular primary care physician started by irrigating the ears regularly. That seemed to just make it worse. Mm. Working with an EMT now who says that I have kind of a complicated cocktail
right.
of things in my ear. I have bacteria. We cultured it. It came back with bacteria. Also came back with a fungus.
Yep.
So he has tried different drops. It didn't respond to Cipro, which I did for a full course. Then I started an anti-fungus drop in the ear, which seemed to have some results. It was short-lived. And it just keeps reoccurring and reoccurring. And now it's sort of jumped into both ears at the same time. Just had me start taking Ciprodexin, O-T-I-C suspension. And he said that that's his favorite thing to kind of hit many different infections and fungus. So I'm just having a hard time. I'm a full-time teacher and I love what I do. And this is really complicated. My life, my hearing goes in and out.
Mm-hmm.
I have this kind of chronic inflammation that makes me feel like I have bleeds inside of my ear and I want to itch them.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of sloughing of the skin mm-hmm. that comes off in the ear canal. I don't believe it's gotten into the inner ear, middle ear, but I do have a little bit, started having some dizziness that makes me suspicious. At night, I have a kind of a weeping yellow, semi-sticky fluid that comes out. So,
wow, gosh, hon. Well, I have some thoughts about it and a suggestion, so that's good. First of all, I want to talk about biofilms because biofilms are a thing that it's the best analogy I've been able to come up with is a coral reef, right? You've got the coral and you've got all these little different fish that, you know, live and hide in the anemones. And then you've got all the anemones growing on the coral. So you have this really elaborate, it's a community, right, of organisms. And some of them feed the other ones. And it's all just sort of established itself as a real ecology, an ecosystem that's freestanding and self-sustaining. And
sounds like what I have.
You have that. And part of what you've got, and part of the reason you've got it is you've got biofilms in there, and biofilms are put down by the bacteria, but then they can be inhabited by the funguses, and the funguses also produce compounds, some of which probably act as food for the bacteria, and you end up with the release of digestive enzymes. I think the sloughing is probably related to the fungus and their digestive enzymes because they like to break down dead skin. And I think the bacteria are probably responsible for the color, but there could be other things going on. And the stuff that got cultured is probably just the tip of the iceberg, honestly. There's probably a lot more bugs in there, maybe some anaerobes down there and other things that we just, when we do a culture, it's kind of a foot race to see what bacteria can grab the territory. So only the fast growers are going to show up on a culture. And if we let that thing grow and put special food in the culture medium, we might even grow out some mycobacteria, which is like a tuberculosis. There's Mycobacterium marinum, which sometimes it'll get into skin and cause a real persistent infection, like from a scratch in a coral reef, actually, ironically enough. But anyway, where I'm going with this is we got to start attacking the biofilm. And your first doctor who was irrigating you, that was actually a good idea because he or she was trying to break up the biofilm. But the problem is you've also got to dry the ear. If you're going to irrigate the ear, then you need to dry the ear if you're using water or water with peroxide in it. Because if you leave water behind, it defeats itself. So you end up having to also dry the ear. There are a couple of old tricks. You can get something called sulfa methoxyl. It's a sulfa powder. If you try to find that, you can find it on the internet, being on Amazon, being sold from like Mexico. And I think it's sulfa methoxazole, if I'm remembering correctly, that I found. And oh yes, thank you, Charlie. It is sulfa methoxazole. I'll spell that sulfamethoxazole. Because I was taught 30 years ago when I was just a baby medical student about this condition, because it's not, you're not alone. And there weren't as many powerful antibiotics then, but the reason I like this one is it hasn't been around for so long, the bacteria have probably forgotten how to be resistant to it. But I have an even better suggestion, and this is it. I want you to get some colloidal silver. And
okay.
So colloidal silver is very, very toxic to fungus and bacteria.
So
you can buy colloidal silver in a nasal spray form, because this is what chronic sinusitis is. You've gotten a biofilm in your sinuses, and it's really hard. What they end up doing in chronic sinusitis is scraping out the inside of the sinus, like when you do a D&C for excess growth in the uterus. You're actually scraping out the growth and hoping that you get it all, which of course you never do. So that's why surgery for chronic sinusitis works for about 5 years. And then the coral reef has regrown itself, and off to the races we go. So using regular colloidal silver, which nothing has ever managed to become resistant to because of the mechanism of action.
Okay.
So getting colloidal silver in there is one step. Making sure that that the Dex in that product that your doctor said he liked isn't a steroid, because I'm worried about that.
It is. That's a steroid.
Yeah, so
he gave me the steroid.
Yeah, steroids no bueno, because they reduce inflammation, but they also reduce inflammation. So your own immune system is being kind of hobbled by the steroid at the same, and fungus just love steroids. It causes a bloom.
Ooh,
so it's like, you
great.
Know, when you get the green bloom in the lake because the fertilizer ran off, that's what
Got
you get
it.
With steroids. So I think steroids are really bad for permanent biofilm conditions, but they do reduce symptoms. And if you don't know, sometimes people are just like, I got to get the symptoms down because the person's miserable. And I understand that, and I'm not condemning it, but it in long term is not a good solution. And so
it doesn't help.
It doesn't help. So I think irrigation, going back to irrigation, and you might actually want to get one of those colloidal silver machines that makes it and irrigate your ear with colloidal silver. I think you can pick one up for $40 or $50. And so make colloidal silver. It should be a little bit foggy looking. That's the good stuff. And essentially, it's an electrolytic process. So you're just electrically taking silver off of the metal and putting it in a fluid. And then you're going to dump that fluid in your ear. And then you're going to use a drying agent to dry your ear. So the best drying agent I know of is squirting air in there. So puffing lots of air after you've done this to dry the silver out, dry the liquid out. And a hairdryer will work if you keep it on low and just blow air in there for 2 or 3 minutes after you've done the thing. Pull the earlobe down while you do it, because then you have a straight shot into the ear canal. And dry it out, hit it with colloidal silver, dry that out, and good luck. Let me know how, you'll know probably in a few weeks whether you're making progress.
I am so grateful for your help. I was getting kind of depressed because it was a cycle. So thank you so much. I will let you know how this works, and I just appreciate your information, and I feel a little bit of hope, and I'll be able to hear again.
Excellent. All right.
Thank
bye for
much.
Now, and keep listening. You're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn, and I'll be here every Wednesday at 6 p.m. on KSQID 90.7 FM. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast.
please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.